Hey, I'm Autumn Calabrese, and I have a question for you. How do you do life? I might be a superstar trainer, but I'm also a boy mom, sister, daughter, friend, and entrepreneur. You might think my life is all working out and cooking healthy, delicious recipes, but trust me, there is so much more to it, and this is it. This is all of those real moments you talk about with your family and friends. Ever wonder what else life has to offer? Bring your curious appetite and let's do life together. Subscribe now at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and PodcastOne.com.
Hey, everybody, Dr. Drew here, Dr. Drew Podcast. Thank you for joining us and continue to support the people who support the Corolla pirate ship here. We appreciate that. And check out all my stuff at drdrew.com. My guest is Ashley Winter. Her podcast is The Full Release Podcast. New episodes Thursday on iTunes, co-hosted with Mo Mandel, also Ashley's fiance. Twitter and Instagram at Ashley G. Winter. Ashley is a urologist, and I love talking to her. Ashley, welcome.
Thanks. It's great being here.
It's a crazy and interesting time to talk to you.
I know. Have
they suspended all voluntary or the surgeries for you?
Yeah, I mean, this is just an absolutely unprecedented time, of course, for everybody. But in the active healthcare environment, it's just an absolute upheaval. So, some things that are happening currently within the health system I work. All elective surgeries have been canceled.
Yeah.
And then, obviously urgent life-threatening things are being done. And then, you kind of have this in-between area where it's much more complicated. So, people who have cancers, but let's say, what sort of delay associated with treating cancer, X.
Right.
Is going to significantly impact that patient's chance of survival, right? And some cancers are very slow moving, and you could say, okay, let's wait till this all blows over. But then there are some types of cancers where it's, not so clear. And then, the other difficulty that we all have in the back of our minds is saying, it's one thing to have this preparedness this week and the next week, but we specifically don't operate with a lot of, extra time in our schedule.
Right.
So once we resume normal activities, all those people who then suddenly need cancer surgery yesterday, when do they get done? And what's going to be the capacity?
Yeah, this is the part that I keep saying, which is that the standing still for a minute is we pretty much got that. But when we get things going again and how we get things going again, that's a tougher putt.
I mean, it's going to be an absolute I hope it's not going to be a disaster, but it is going to be a tremendous and formidable process getting up to speed with that.
And not causing another outbreak.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and, from that standpoint, there are things that we are trying to do to mitigate the loss in care that is occurring. And this is a big thing that I've been, I find that it's all consuming to watch the news cycle right now and be on Twitter. And one of the things that I, did hear today from the White House press conference.
And let me say, this is March 17th as we record this. Go ahead. The press conference was very.
Well, I would say I was very happy to hear that they put out a statement saying that telehealth would be supported by Medicare.
Yep.
And I mean, that is absolutely tremendous. And I think for the health system as a whole, that is, I'm just extremely happy that the conversation wasn't just about masks and ventilators, but also how do we address care in a way that's also not compromising people's health and allowing them to be at home and supporting physicians.
Absolutely. Listen, I've been saying this all along, that there will be evolution as a result of this. Right, things will evolve in leaps and starts in response to this that hopefully we can keep in place after we're done.
Well, and I'll say, see, I currently work at Kaiser Permanente, which is a larger, a large HMO system. And one of the aspects of working here that I found so satisfying was the opportunity to, let's say, do just phone calls and get compensated appropriately for that. Because, for example, somebody has a kidney stone. I've already seen their CAT scan. I know what their lab results are.
Yeah.
I know all the tests. So really, I have to call that person. I have to have a discussion with them about what their pain levels are and what they want to do. You know, should we do surgery? Should we wait? Should we give you medication?
Let me say, as opposed to, I spend 2 hours a day on the phone compensated for none of it.
Right.
None. Zero.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And you talk about healthcare efficiencies, right? The tremendous discussion of our time before this from a healthcare standpoint was off, right? And so if I can have a conversation with a patient about their kidney stone without disrupting, let's say they're 45 and they're a business person, they don't have to leave work, right?
Right.
They can just get on the phone. So that's an economic loss they're not having because we're having a telemedicine encounter. Mm-hmm. I don't have to bring them into the office. I don't have to have a medical assistant room them. We don't have to take their vital signs if they're otherwise well. So all of these are costs that don't necessarily contribute to value. And it's so simple. I mean, it's one of the most simple things you can do is just compensate, you know, medical decision making and care conversations rather than, you know, being face to face.
Yep.
And I think this is, a watershed occurrence for moving, American healthcare in that direction.
I agree.
When appropriate.
And when they say telemedicine, they're not talking about Skyping and Zooming. They're talking about any across a wire contact. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, there are different – I mean, we definitely have this patient privacy secure video conferencing platform. But, I have a lot of patients who are, let's say, 90 years old and they
can't do it.
They don't have a computer.
No,
so you call that person up. They just want to call on their phone line.
Yep. Yep.
And they want to talk to you and they don't care, So I think that's another part of this is I have seen a preferential kind of discrimination over video conferencing versus telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think fundamentally if the care is appropriate for a phone conversation, then that should be, just as good.
Now you spend most of your day doing elective procedures. Are they redeploying you for other things? That's something I'm curious about, people that are in very specified areas. Are you getting deployed or are you getting prepared to be deployed in certain ways that you don't normally practice?
Yeah, so this is also a great point. I did get an email from our, I think it was our hospital CMO last night saying, because I have admitting privileges, right? So there are only certain physicians that are able to take care of people who are technically hospitalized.
Right.
So, certain doctors, let's say an eye doctor oftentimes don't have that capacity, but since I technically have admitting privileges, they did send an email to a wide swath of the staff who has admitting privileges at our hospital, essentially saying that we may be called upon to perform some sort of, alternate duties. And they phrased it in the form of hospitalist duties, which, for people listening who aren't familiar, that's basically internal medicine. So people coming in with whatever, pneumonia or chest pain and,
stuff.
Yeah. And I will say I immediately, went to a bunch of my friends and said, oh my God, can somebody review EKGs with me? Because I have not cared about that in over a decade. I finished med school in 2010. I have been, 99% below the belt since then.
That's hysterical.
I heard
Kaiser was also sending stuff out to retired ER docs, and I gave up my admitting privileges about 8 years ago, and I'm saying bring me back, I'll go in, I'm ready to go as soon as they need me, I'm in. The other thing I heard is that they're pulling residents. Have you heard that? To me, that's the worst idea in the world. Have you heard
I had not heard that.
I mean,
they weren't allowing them to.
They're either pulling them. I don't know their reasoning. Maybe they have the hospital actually has liability over residents because they're an employee, or they're giving the residents the options not to come in if they're fearful. And to me, it's like, no, you step up as a physician. This is when you this is what you took your oath for. This is when you step up.
Well, I know, for example, that I haven't heard anything about residents within our institution. I have heard, for example, for surgical cases that do continue right now, emergent or, semi-emergent, that they wanted residents to continue scrubbing in, but they did not want medical students to continue scrubbing in.
I heard that too.
And that was for the use.
For the what?
Protective masks and whatnot. Now, I hope, I truly hope that they are still utilizing med students, because med students are an absolutely tremendous resource. Yeah. And, you know, when you think about people who know the hospital well, who can go between services, because within the past year, they've worked in surgery and internal medicine and gynecology, and who can, you know, run labs and help with procedures. And, you know, I just, this is a watershed learning moment. And I hope that they are all, you know, encouraged to be a part of that.
Yes,
you know,
agreed.
Of course, with the reminder that we're all safe, but.
Yeah, I agree, and I would say that it's the hospital's responsibility to set the infection control standards that will keep them safe, and they just need to do those practices, and we will be fine. But to pull them, God, I mean, that is the wrong way to train physicians, but it doesn't surprise me given the way things have been going recently. But whatever, we'll see how this plays out. What other things do you think might come out of this that could be positive for us all? We've got telemedicine. We got you sharpening your skills.
It's really interesting. I think, you know, one thing I was thinking about today, as also we're all on the internet and on Twitter and all looking at this, is kind of really honing in physician sense of acuity over medical disinformation. And I'd say that is probably a big part of this. Mm-hmm. So I think physicians, you know, kind of, you know, sifting through Twitter, asking people, where did you hear that information? What's the basis of this? Like fact checking, because right now we are, the amount of disinformation or misinformation or miscommunication is absolutely enormous. And
staggering.
The fear, and lives that could be lost because of that misinformation is tremendous. So
that's right.
I was actually thinking about this also because I was looking at a recent neurologic journal, and they had been going through YouTube videos about, for example, testosterone, and they were also going through YouTube videos about premature ejaculation, neither of which have anything to do with coronavirus per se, but those are things that I read about. And they had gone through and were looking at the percentage of, you know, videos on YouTube that had medically accurate information, and also how well those did in the algorithms of social media. And, you know, which we would all assume that the medically appropriate or medically accurate videos were oftentimes not doing well in algorithms, not getting many clicks, and, you know, performing significantly worse than videos that had bad information, right?
Yep.
And it seems like such a simple idea, but I love that physicians are starting to be cognizant of this and publish on it and talk about it and engage in that. And perhaps this will be a catalyst for more people to engage, you know, who have a medical background, to engage in public conversations about health the way you have done for many years. But most people really have felt like it wasn't necessary.
Oh, my God. Oof. It is so necessary. I think you're coming to realize that now. I remember when we first met, you made the rounds to expert podcast, and you were shocked at what the experts knew. And I told you, you're the expert. There's so many of these experts. I mean, the training is just – they're none to ridiculous. If somebody does not have a letters across their name that suggest high-level clinical training, they should not be calling themselves an expert.
Right, right. And you know, you think – I mean, I was thinking when I was a kid and, you know, before internet and when the internet was new, you know, if you had a question about something in health and it wasn't in your – you know, the book you had been reading, or, you know, something you found at the physical public library, you probably asked your doctor.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And so there was so much more of, you know, a way of funneling information through reliable sources, right? Like, your public library isn't going to buy books full of garbage, you know, predicated on people trying to make money off of selling something.
Right.
And your doctor's not going to do the same thing either.
Right.
And so it wasn't a problem, and the medical community developed this idea that you would convey information to patients when you saw them in the office, and the rest of the time, you're going to go to your conferences and talk amongst yourself, right?
Yep.
And that's fine at that time, but it's not.
There was one other. There was one other thing you didn't have to live with that I had to spend many long hours working through. Is something called the Index Medicus. You ever hear of that?
No.
Okay. It was this thing that was published every month that was a very complicated maze of medical literature. In other words, it was by topic and author,
right.
And it was in every year the publication this. It was a reference manual, and the reference manual by the end of the year was about 8 feet long. And it was usually done by time and alphabet, and you'd have to go through it and figure out and then find the article and then copy the article. It was crazy long hours. Every call night was spent at least 3 hours a night in the Index Medicus, you know, trying to find stuff. And that was cumbersome. That was crazy when we had to do that. And it's so weird to me to think you just enter your question into your phone now and it comes up while you're standing at the bedside.
No, it's incredible. I mean, I was thinking about how absurd it was. I remember when I was a kid, you know, you'd see on TV the ads for Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
And now you have probably, you know, 800,000 times more information on Wikipedia.
Yep.
And it doesn't take up half your living room. And, and so much faster to find. And, you know, with medicine, obviously, it's just, you know, in a real time sensitive way, important to be able to do that. But, you know, kind of circling back to this whole thing about disinformation, you know, what I'd love to see is, you know, instead of when residents are applying or med students are applying for residency or residents are applying for, you know, positions or academic jobs, that instead of just saying, oh, how many, you know, abstracts did you or, you know, research projects did you present to this conference, but kind of what did you do to shape, you know, health narratives?
Mm. Like, interesting.
And I would love to see that become a relevant conversation, you know, and I'm not saying you have to have a viral YouTube channel, but what does that mean, you know?
Yes. So we should have a way of measuring that and assessing that. That's a really good idea. We don't now.
Yeah. I think that is a, you know, a moment that we will either, you know, lose or champion. And, you know, I see lots of kind of anti-physician sentiment in the public space now, and that is a battle we shouldn't be losing. That's just crazy. Like, our whole job is to help people out, you know?
Yeah, the people are very confused about what we do and don't really understand the different disciplines and how it works, and except when they have need, then they're happy to come. I'm wondering if the corona outbreak will increase or decrease faith. I don't know. It'll be interesting.
I really also hope this coronavirus, I hope we get a good vaccine, and I hope it just eliminates the whole anti-vaxxer thing.
Wouldn't that be nice? I don't think it will, but it'd be nice if it did. So, yes.
I know. And I would love to see if people who are against the vaccines are also against receiving the coronavirus vaccine. And, like, if they stand up and want it now, then thank God.
The thinking is so rigid. They're still going to take aim at measles, no matter how you shape it. So whatever. At least they'll take the flu and the corona vaccines. Let's go back to some fun stuff. What are you covering now on your podcast?
I feel ashamed to say this, but we've been doing it with less frequency now. We had been doing it every single week for probably a year and a half, and then I was planning our wedding, and then I'm also actively looking for jobs in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
because I'm moving down there. So it's just been absolutely crazy.
Let's get our mind off all this other stuff. Talk about urology for a few minutes. Any new breaking ideas? Any things you're excited about? Topics that you're concerned with?
My mind has been so consumed with coronavirus.
I know, me too.
You know, I can't say there's been a lot that's revolutionary. I think, you know, when I was looking at recent publications, you know, I have started to see people talking in the medical literature a little bit more about, you know, the relationship between cannabis and sexual activity, which I thought was interesting.
In what sense? What direction?
You mean pro or con?
Yeah.
So again, the data is not excellent because this is all so new that we're getting en masse, you know, access to this, and the kind of permission on a legal level to study it, because before, you know, that basically was just so restricted, you couldn't possibly do that. But generally, the basic principles are that in the, you know, it's very complex, obviously. Mm-hmm. In the acute sense and at a moderate dose, there can be a beneficial effect.
Uh-huh.
Meaning, like, you know, if you're having some issues with libido and it's something you wanted to try and you wanted to try a small dose, you know, that there can potentially be a improvement, you know, in your arousal and orgasm intensity, potentially. Now, you know, that's not consistent person to person. And obviously, you know, the preparations and formulations of cannabis and the amount of THC that people get is so variable across all the reports. But in general, you know, high doses and long-term use, you know, is generally more negative for sexual life.
Got it.
So, and I mean, I think we all kind of know that if you're like a stoner eating, you know, whatever, like, you know, lots of, I don't know, you know, whatever, you're not necessarily incentivized to be highly sexually active. And there is some, you know, physiologic, you know, hard facts that we have that, you know, it can downregulate some of your hormonal response and lower your testosterone. So, you know, probably if you were interested in using it as a sexual enhancer, you're going to be looking at using it, you know, in moderate or low doses on specific occasions, and probably try to avoid being like, you know, a high dose habitual marijuana user. So
let's swing back around. You said just mentioned the topic of testosterone. So we've got now Joe Rogan saying that it's categorically clear that everyone over a certain age, male, should be on hormone replacement therapy. Where do you come in on this one?
Oh, that is just crazy. I mean, everybody who has a low testosterone and has symptoms of low testosterone should receive a trial of testosterone replacement therapy if they want to. And if they receive a benefit, then they can continue that. You know, that is the bottom line. I mean, you know, there are men who are of a certain age that have a normal testosterone.
Yeah.
And, you know, telling that person that they have to, you know, be on more is just like, whatever. I mean, you know, and obviously certain components of, you know, testosterone do have more of a linear response, meaning like if you have higher baseline testosterone because you supplement, then you probably will have more, you know, lean muscle mass, for mm-hmm. example. And mm-hmm. and there's, you know, somewhat a linear correlation with that. Now, you know, other aspects of testosterone physiology do not have that linear response. So for example, you know, erections. Once you reach around the lower limit of normal, giving you more testosterone will not have cause more responsiveness in your penile tissue. That's just a fact. So, you know, if your testosterone level is 500, giving you testosterone to make your testosterone level 900 is going to have zero effect on your penis.
But it might affect libido and orgasmic function, right?
Possibly. Yeah. Possibly.
Yeah.
And one of the complexities here is that we also know that it does vary person to person. So, you know, on a cellular basis, some people have a much more sensitive intracellular androgen receptor, meaning that, you know, that person can live at a lower total testosterone blood test,
right,
and have all the good stuff. And some other guy is going to be in a normal range and probably not seeing the manifestation of that. And unfortunately, we have absolutely zero way to measure somebody's androgen receptor sensitivity.
Another way of saying this, we don't know what the normal circulating testosterone should be for a given individual.
Yes.
We don't have it. Then that's why the normal range is so broad.
Yeah. And I think another, you know, scary thing that I see insurances decline testosterone supplementation because somebody's testosterone level is above the lower limit of the normal range, defined for that lab.
Yes.
And the problem is that the labs are often based on standard deviations from the tests coming in.
Yep.
Now, if the standard deviation of men are obese and have sleep apnea and diabetes, then that group as a cohort does not have a physiologically normal testosterone. So, you know, it's a bad number to go off of the you know, means of that population to define what should be covered and shouldn't be covered.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. It's almost like we should be monitoring testosterone from youth and have a sort of a scattergram for every given individual, what the normal sort of range would be. You know, you'd have to have it across a lifespan almost, and then you take two standard deviations off that or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that is an interesting point. Like, what were your testosterone levels when you felt, you know, a certain way and had a certain BMI and a certain, you know, like robust libido? And, you know, what was that for you?
Yep.
And, you know, maybe that's the normal for you. That's a very fascinating point and something definitely nobody's ever looked at.
Yeah. And I kind of feel like one day we will. There's going to be something like that. I would love to take testosterone, but my prostate cancer prevents me, at least for the time being.
No. But do you have a detectable PSA?
0.02.
Okay. And what was your, if you don't mind me asking, do you remember what your Gleason score or your
six, six, six.
Yeah.
Moderate volume, good margins. It was midline tumor with a little more volume than you'd like. But it was all Gleason 6, some 5, and that's it. And it's 0.02 now.
I would tell you that based on your prostate cancer history alone, you are a reasonable candidate. Now, you know, for sure.
Oh,
and,
man.
You know,
don't tap
a
me.
Ton of urologists would tell you that
When you move down here, we're going to talk.
you can be my patient. I will prescribe you testosterone.
I want to see if I want to make sure I don't have any, because I was 0.0 after my surgery, and then I was 0.2, and then 0.4, and then 0.2, and it's like or 0.02, and I'm just kind of like, I want to see where the graph goes for a little while before I make a full decision on this one.
Yeah, you know, but this is the thing. So if you look at the association between also testosterone stimulation and prostate cancer, a lot of it also caps off around the lower limit of normal. So meaning if your testosterone is, you know, 300, giving you more testosterone is not going to stimulate the prostate cancer.
I vary a lot, but I'm between like 400 and 600, but I know that's not my normal. I just know it. I can tell. So I'm one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Lift
heavy weights. That's all. As best I can sleep enough. Lift heavy weights. That's all. Right. Let's again go back to the stuff that is interesting to you. I'm just imagining that the transgender field is sort of something you get called upon to talk about once in a while or at least comment on. What kinds of stuff are you doing there? Are you interested in?
So I do get questions about it. Originally, before I took my first job out of training, I had actually almost very narrowly turned down a job that would be full-time
gender assignment.
Gender affirming, surgery, full-time.
Yeah.
And I ultimately decided not to do that. And it wasn't because I didn't have an interest in it, a very keen interest in it. It was just, you know, various aspects kind of about the job and the location. And, I just decided not to do that. But, the surgeries are absolutely wonderful to do. I'm not currently doing them. I think they are something, you know, as a community of urologists that, we all have now realized we have to, become knowledgeable about, because those patients are oftentimes very young and oftentimes have lots of complications. And oftentimes the reconstructive surgeon who did their primary, let's say, phalloplasty, will not live within hundreds of miles of them. So we're all going to have to, you know, understand how to take care of this, you know, those patients and do as best a job as possible doing that. So, you know, it's really just kind of bringing in a whole new class of conditions kind of en masse. I mean, obviously, you know, transgender people are not a tremendous percentage of the population, but, you know, for the amount and intensity of care they require, you know, it's not an insignificant proportion of urologic care. And that those are, you know, things we're going to be seeing. And I, you know, I haven't seen it yet on our boards, for example, but I'm sure, and I mean, I took my oral boards last year, but I'm sure it will soon become, you know,
more routine.
Yeah. Yeah.
What kinds of complications are you referring to?
So for example, you know, with female to male, so you have phalloplasty, you know, essentially, and not everybody, right? This is, of course, for people who have that surgery done. There are plenty of, you know, individuals who are, you know, female to male transgender who decide to not have bottom surgery, for example. Or they have what's called a metoidoplasty, you know, which is where you don't have a graft put in for a phallus or a new penis, but actually you take the clitoris, which has been enlarged from, you know, high doses of testosterone, and you, you know, can do some reconstructive manipulation to, you know, generate more of a penis-like appearance without actually, you know, transposing tissue. So that's metoidoplasty. And then phalloplasty is basically where you take an actual free flap, usually from, right, the arm or the thigh, and you take that piece of tissue and you entirely disconnect it and then reconnect it, you know, in the area of where the clitoris is, and try to attach, you know, the vasculature, the nerves, you know, everything. And then you also tubularize it. So kind of like, you know, roll it like you would, like a jelly roll, and you put a urethra through the middle of it. So in those individuals, right, things that you could get are strictures of that.
And do you put your fancy devices in there for erections?
Oh yeah. So this is all a great point. So we do, and it's very interesting. So, for example, in Europe, when they do phalloplasty, there is a specific penile prosthesis designed for transgender persons that, you know, has like a bone anchor component for the pubic bone, mm-hmm. And kind of like a one piece, right? The penile implant we have here is two cylinders, because that's the way the native penis is designed. So you put one cylinder in each half of your shaft, right?
Yep.
Because you have two natural chambers that way. But when you have a neophallus, which is essentially composed of fatty tissue, let's say from your thigh, it doesn't have those separate compartments. So you mm-hmm. can't put those two cylinders in, because they will like cross each other, they'll bend, it just, there's no kind of thing really linking them.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes now they're just putting in one cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not adequate. Now the technology exists and the devices exist. It's just that the FDA hasn't approved any of them yet. And I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that is a real kind of barrier to people having, you know, the best type of erection in the neophallus.
And you mentioned that you were attaching the nerves in the neophallus. Is there actually feeling?
Yeah. So, recently there's definitely feeling. And there are individuals who also say that they have, you know, satisfactory orgasm associated with stimulation of the neophallus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what they are doing is essentially connecting one of the nerves of the arm to the dorsal clitoral nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the amount to which that, you know, will successfully attach, I think is varied. But I remember one of my initial criticisms in the past few years when the rate of, you know, gender affirming surgery went up exponentially was that this was kind of a bandwagon that so many people were jumping on in the urologic community because they're interesting surgeries to do and they're fun surgeries to do. And it can greatly increase your operative volume if you start doing that. But what did we understand from a functional standpoint about what we were doing?
And by the way, satisfaction of the patients. Did you have the track record to know that people were happy with this?
Right. So, you know, there was this moment where it suddenly became the thing to do and then everybody started doing it. And I had a concern that there were people who I saw in the broader community who had never been interested in, you know, gender nonconformity in gender reassignment, you know, as a, from a community standpoint, from an intellectual standpoint. And then when the opportunity to do the surgery came around, then they were suddenly the biggest advocate. And, you know, I understand that you can still have a positive outcome without necessarily the most pure of intent. But you do want to make sure that you care about the end goal that is the right end goal for the patient. Not like, oh, hi, I can do this surgery on you.
Right.
But do I understand what your gender means to you and how to do the best for you that way?
Yep.
And for example, like you said, like between the two options of doing a phalloplasty or a metoidoplasty or doing nothing, right? There are people who are transgender who are going to be the right match for each three of those. And, you know, that's like just really important. But even more on a sophisticated level, you know, amongst people who do have that phalloplasty, right? The big penis put on.
The big penis put on, yes.
Really big. There was a great, there was a great study. I think it was some residents did. They measured the average circumference of the most popular dildos on Amazon. And then they measured the average circumference of a phalloplasty, like a neophallus, made from a thigh. And that was so much, and I think even just also a neophallus from an arm, because that's usually thinner. And most of the penises that were being made by urologists and plastic surgeons was way girthier than like, even like popular dildo sizes,
right,
and probably way girthier than like an average man's penis by like a significant amount, right?
Yep.
So we're probably getting ahead of ourselves. And we're just like, oh, we can make you the biggest penis you possibly could have. That's
right.
What's that?
Right.
Like, well, you can't insert that. Maybe it's not the best, right?
Right.
You know?
Let me talk about the male to female. Did you were you mostly doing female to male, or do you also get interested in the female to male?
Male to female. Male to female. Yeah. No. And that is something we also certainly have exposure to. And those raise all these, you know, important questions for urologists. For example, you know, male to female transgender persons, you know, are going to have prostate cancer screening.
Right.
And, you know, they're going to have their PSA checked and they're going to have to rectal exam. And, you know, you have certain people come in and you want to make sure to broach those topics without negating their gender, right? Like saying, okay, you have to come see me. You need a prostate exam. You know, and being sensitive to kind of the complexities around that, whether or not that person, you know, is, let's say, in touch with that organ or not, you know, so those are things that we're going to have to kind of continue to stay, you know, aware of. And I think also we'll be looking, you know, very intensely over time, how, you know, years of hormone manipulation will affect, you know, the presentation of types of cancers.
Yeah. Interesting. And the female to male, are you doing anything with the pelvic organs? Per se,
female to male.
In other words, they need ovarian cancer screening, uterine cancer screening, that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, so people who go ahead with a bottom surgery who are female to male oftentimes will have a hysterectomy done.
Oophorectomy too?
No, I can't recall offhand, and that's a great question.
Yeah. I mean, I'd get them both just to get the cancer risk out of there. It's not doing anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But certainly the other main reason to do a hysterectomy is because at the time of the reconstruction, you remove most of the vagina,
right?
And you use some of that tissue for making the urethra, one, and two, you want to take it out because you can get fistula, and so
interesting,
you know, or not necessarily removing all of it, but kind of obliterating some of the mucosal lining there, but certainly, you know, it's a hysterectomy would be a standard of care if you're going ahead with a full transition surgery.
And the reason we don't take the prostate, that's a bigger operation, and it also can damage the nerves that you're going to be relying on to the penis.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for a number of reasons. One, if we took that out, and so think about, right, radical prostatectomy and incontinence. So yep. So all those women would now be at immediate risk of stress incontinence.
Yep.
And even more so, you know, you're removing all their penile urethra. So they would probably all be leaking. And you know, then there's also, prostatectomy is a complicated surgery. I mean, you could get a rectal injury, right?
Yep.
I mean, so it's just not, you know, and then on top of that, you know, there's the argument that is in and of itself a, you know, orgasmic organ. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are people who may, you know, want to leave it in.
to leave it around just in case.
yeah, exactly.
Does it, and it will continue to produce fluid, right? The seminal vascles ran behind and stuff. And so it's something that, how's that work?
Yeah. I mean, and these are things, again, since I personally, you know, this is all like learnings I have from when I was kind of going in that direction of potentially taking one of those jobs and, you know, seeing a bunch of those surgeries, and not necessarily an active component of my current practice, you would still have a significant volume of prostate excretions, I would expect. Obviously the testicles are removed, but of course, you know, 90% of your ejaculate or more is not related to your testicles. So,
right.
I would expect that you would have that and, you know, probably just utilize, there are women who ejaculate. So,
yeah.
You know.
So it'll just be like that. Interesting. I mean, people don't talk about that or think about that.
Yeah. No. So this is, I was very, when I was saying before that there was some concern I had initially in that moment about, you know, are we going to just take this on as, you know, kind of surgeons who, you know, just want to do surgery? Are we really going to start to understand this? And I remember at our national conference last year, there were some really great research studies who had followed people who had undergone bottom surgery and started looking at, their sexual function and their satisfaction, not just, you know, and the initial presentations I was seeing, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago were just, look how many I did, look how long it took me, this was my complication rate, this is how many infections occurred, right?
Right.
And those aren't like ultimately the important things to the people receiving those surgeries. It's, you know, I mean, it's the same prostate cancer, right? You want to know that the cancer is gone, you want to have potency, you want to be dry, you want to live longer. So for these people, it's not, right, like how long you were in the hospital, it's you know, are they happy,
right,
and functional?
What the data look like?
It was surprising. I recall it being surprisingly positive that there were such a high number of people who were having, satisfactory sexual activity and who were orgasmic, which is something, you know, I was somewhat incredulous that, taking, you know, the clitoral nerves and attaching it to arm nerves could produce kind of erotic feeling that, you know, is, apparently there are people who are very successful in achieving that. And this is just, it's all revolutionary kind of what the information this will give us about understanding, you know, just sex in general.
Yeah. Do me a favor. If you come across that data, do me a favor and send me whatever the publications you come across. All right. Well, listen, Ashley, fascinating conversation, and thank you for covering a lot of territory today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And as I said, understand you're the expert. People should be coming to you for this information, not other people declaring their expertise. Only it should come from you, and they're welcome. I hope you feel comfortable with people quoting you, which I think is fine. But they shouldn't be marching off their own direction without checking in with a real expert, and you are that. We will look for you on Twitter and Instagram at Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-Y, G, Winter, and you and I will talk again soon. When are you likely to come down here?
By the end of the year, full time.
All right. Well, then we're going to pull you in here a bunch more. All right?
Oh, I love it. Can't wait. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Ashley. Thanks so much.
All right. Yeah, thank you.
See you next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.